Well, time is always of the essence, so let's make a start. And as the module handbook suggests, today is a kind of combination, a portmanteau of two wonderful texts, one of which you may be more familiar with than others, one of which you might have heard about, both of which I venture to suggest actually take us into inner space, worlds of the mind. Now, arguably, science fiction does that as a standard trope. And we've looked so far over the last 3 weeks at how it's employed things like natural selection, it's employed things like scientific discoveries, ideologies, Fordism, evolution, and so on, to start addressing concerns and fears within contemporary society and so on. What we're doing this week is really looking at that whole notion of exploring what it is to be ourselves in terms of consciousness. Not human, but something which kind of explores inner space and sees that as significant in its own way as outer space. What Ballard brings us is the start of a really key part of science fiction history. It's the first time in many ways, together with authors like Michael Moorcock, with writers such as Brian Aldiss, that what we refer to now as the new wave of British science fiction writers really started beginning to develop. And in terms of that new wave, there were people who were very much influenced by some of the traditional science fiction writers, the A.E. van Vogts, the Isaac Asimovs, the Robert Heinleins, the Arthur C. Clarkes, and obviously the H.G. Wells, Jules Verne, Mary Shelley, and so on. But what we were getting at here was something that applied what Ballard actually says is something which is more adult than the traditional notion of science fiction being about rocket ships and adventures and far-off spaceships and far-off planets and lands and robots and killer robots and alien invasions and so on. But he's really arguing for something which starts dealing with internal monologues. And that whole notion of how do we sense time passing? How do we actually relate to this? The two images I put up there, which are obviously in terms of the learning materials on Blackboard that you can stare at, legislate, see what it actually means to you. Very much the search of St. Anthony, the sort of line from that. Versuchen des Heiliger Antonius, Max Ernst, line there. And Dali's kind of classic notion there of swans reflecting elephants. It's deliberately tapping into the aspects that we refer to as surrealism. Surrealism, from the French, literally on the real, above and beyond the real. You can also argue that from a science fiction point of view, it's looking at making things strange. It's the novum, Starko Suvin would say. It's the Verfremdungseffekt that we actually see manifest in so much science fiction, which is part of the reason, let's be honest, it gives us a pleasure to actually have that weirdness, the sense of the unreal, the sense of the uncanny, and so on. So why, you might well ask, am I actually looking to develop these two things in two texts which initially would might seem to be polar opposites? Dune, massive, grand space opera, huge galactic empires, galactic novels, and so on. And Drowned World Eco-Catastrophe. It's Earth, but not as we know it. Possibly an alternate Earth. Possibly an Earth of our near future. Possibly an apocalyptic aspect. Where, clearly, what we have, as we discover through the novel, is the city of London submerged underwater. And we see the narrative progress from Curran's opening his sort of exploration and his connection with a whole range of fine folk with that opening line, which is sort of resonant with the whole sort of text, that it's a very hot and environmentally oppressive environment that we're faced with it. Is there any major difference between what we see here and arguably the elements that we see in this particular catastrophic element?
Time is now 10:46. 40 minutes before countdown. inside. The time is now 10:51. 9 minutes before countdown. 9 minutes.
9 minutes before countdown. 9 minutes while the world waits and wonders. Care if you dare the unbearable suspense of men and women who have never in their lives faced greater peril. The day the earth caught fire will burn itself into your memory. Is it fiction or is it fact?
What's the mutation of the earth? Mutation? Well, it's a slight oscillation on the earth axis, caused by the pull of the sun and moon.
It's on the equator.
You see, there's a flat power coming.
There's also an item here about axis rotation. There's been a little bit of variation, whatever that may mean.
They shifted the tilt of the earth. The stupid, crazy, irresponsible punkless. They've finally done it.
From the presses of Fleet Street, today's headlines blaze into tomorrow's history. And here are the people who report the most sensational story a newspaper has ever had to print. A story that might be the last it ever prints. These are the people caught in the most explosive threat ever to face the world. Jeannie, the girl on the government switchboard. And Steny, one-time ace reporter, striving to make a comeback in life and love.
You happen to walk in at the end of a Black Monday.
What about Tony Sunday?
Oh, come on, love. People, too.
Oh,
lovely.
Not so well.
Look, I think you could use the phone.
Oh, come on, now, Jeannie. What do you want? Slow builder, finance and movies, meet troubles and a coffee bar.
This is McGuire, the science editor who unearthed the deadly facts.
What the hell kind of fog really comes up to the fourth floor?
I have no friend when they come up here. This place is like an angry root of hell.
It's really chaos. The London airport, Mr. McGuire.
You do it.
Question is, how do we get home tonight?
Yes, I know. Isn't it wonderful?
Let's sit down.
Turns out
they were...
Soon, huh?
22. 21.
Is the luck of the human race.
The day the earth caught fire, fearlessly tackles a ferocious subject. It will seize your imagination, stretch your nerves with suspense more compelling than any you have known in a cinema before.
4. 3. 2.
Soon it would be too hot. Looking out from the hotel balcony shortly after 8 o'clock, Karens watch the sun rise behind the dense groves of giant gymnosperms crowding over the roofs of the abandoned department stores 400 yards away on the east shore of the lagoon. What this Valguest movie suggests, in essence, has nothing to do as such with the drowned world, although arguably Ballard would have been influenced by this kind of eco-catastrophe movie, is the sense that actually the Earth has been tilted slightly off its axis as a result of nuclear bomb testing. Again, you can see this was 1961. From a slightly more up-to-date version, one which you may also be familiar with, maybe the postscript to Drowned World, of course the Kevin Costner Hollywood epic, which is Waterworld.
The sun, for millions of years, the source of life, but for one planet, the source of its demise. The temperatures climbed, the vast fields of ice as poles melted, and the oceans rose. Centuries later, few people remained on this planet once called Earth.
Thank you.
but nevertheless one that certainly has its antecedents with respect to the drowned world and so on. And we'll come on to talk about the connection between water in particular and Dune in a few moments. But, as Martin Amis writes in his introduction forward, Ballard's not really about prediction. Neither really is science fiction. We've talked a great deal about the prescience of science fiction, the notion of kind of being in touch as a prophet, as a soothsayer, and saying, this is going to happen, this is what's going to take place, and so on. But in actual fact, it's a small part, a relatively small part, of what all science fiction is. We never really find out what's caused the oceans to rise in the drowned world. There's never any indication that we know exactly what's happened, or why we seem to be progressing backwards in time. Is it a cyclical thing? As we actually gradually go through this particular period, it's a perfectly natural line in which civilizations rise and civilizations fall. And the sequence where Currens himself actually gets into his underwater diving gear and dives down to the surface of the whole water. What's really significant about the place that he goes to? Which place in London does he effectively come to? Does he actually sort of start wandering around at and see? First place that's submerged. No, not the race, because he's living in there, but in terms of when he goes in underwater and actually dives under his diving costume.
A planetarium.
Really interesting line in terms of that. He's going under to see the outer. And so much of Ballard's writing echoes that. Now let's consider some of Ballard's background. After all, we did this for H.G. Wells. We also looked at it from the point of view of Carol Čapek. Let's look at some of the biography with respect to Ballard. Ballard was brought up in the Second World War. He was a prisoner of war as a child. In fact, the novel and subsequent movie, which was Christian Bale's first ever movie role, was Steven Spielberg's Empire of the Sun, which tells the tale of Ballard effectively growing up in a Japanese concentration camp. So that opening line of being too hot and lines from that and areas from that, clearly there's an element that comes across in terms of Ballard's subsequent writing. His use of the internal monologue certainly opens up the whole range of where we see the characters developing. And indeed, if we're looking for character sympathy, I don't think we can really describe Currens necessarily as a heroic character. Or is he? Or indeed, are other characters that we actually see in terms of the military and the other elements, are they also heroic? Or are they more like the characters that we've seen present in terms of Waterworld, whereby we're looking at elements of the aspects of humanity maybe we want to put to one side and actually address from a different aspect from that point of view. Let's go back to the PDF file. Okay. Yeah. Oh, it's not that one. That one. Oh, yes. You might think, because of the overuse of time, that maybe that is critical to the understanding of Drowned World. I don't think it is. But I do think it's interesting that in terms of what we're looking through this, neuronic time, archaeopsychic time, time jungles, cosmic time, metabiological fantasy. I've already talked about sidereal time, the time it actually takes for the solar system to revolve around the galaxy. Solar time, what we kind of appreciate as time from that perspective. Is that a case of actually the weirdness of going through different time structures? Is it actually, if I cross-reference to Dune and the opening sequence from Dune, appropriate for this particular segment?
The beginning is a very delicate time. Know then that is the year 10,191. The known universe is ruled by the Padishah Emperor Shaddam IV, my father. In this time, the most precious substance in the universe is the spice melange. The spice extends life. The spice expands consciousness. the spice is vital to space travel. The Spacing Guild and its navigators, who the spice has mutated over 4,000 years, use the orange spice gas, which gives them the ability to fold space. That is, travel to any part of the universe without moving. Oh yes, I forgot to tell you. The spice exists on only one planet in the entire universe. A desolate, dry planet with vast deserts. Hidden away within the rocks of these deserts are a people known as the Fremen, who have long held a prophecy that a man would come, a messiah, who would lead them to true freedom. The planet is Arrakis, also known as Dune.
But as I said, given that, as far as we're aware, although we're supposed to be discovering new solar systems which can have habitable life almost on a week-by-week basis, what Herbert's writing about, also in the 1960s, is this whole notion of, let's say, other planets, other developments. Again, we'll talk more about that as we head through this particular development within that. The first question is up there. Currens, described as having an end-of-century temperament, fin de siècle. Seems almost difficult to encapture that now that we're well into the second, approaching the third decade of the 21st century. We've got another 70, 80 years to go before we reach the end of this 21st century, which might just be a cosmic drop in the ocean. But is that a fair comment in terms of what Ballard's putting the whole process together, the whole notion of what he's experiencing? How did you relate to Currens as a character? Did you think, well, what a wimp? Or did you think, they're all wimps, I don't know anything, this is terrible, I have to throw it away?
I'm afraid I didn't read Drowning World, I tried to read Dune and Fables.
Okay.
I have a very brief knowledge of what happens in Drowning World.
Don't worry, let's move on. That's yourself, do you have views on Currens?
I found it quite difficult. I don't feel like he just kind of, I don't know, a bit disengaged.
He's no dead character. I mean, I wouldn't call him a hero or anything, but I think he has good intentions overall.
And in terms of the bad guys that we see, I mean, obviously Strangman and a pack of pillaging crew members. Has anybody actually seen Waterworld here? Yeah, because I mean, there is a definite connection between Strangman and the character played by not Costner, but his name's losing me.
Dennis Hopper.
Thank you, Dennis Hopper, in the sort of aspect within that. But it's again referencing to that. I mean, we're also talking here about the two notions of the drowned world. Is it literally a world that's underwater? In other words, a literal translation of the drowned world, so you know, the whole world's underwater and so on, or the majority of it is. Or is it a dead world? Or is it a world in which the dinosaurs are coming back to life? Why do the characters have dreams? You know, what are their dreams? We talk about this archaeopsychic time. What's the line that Ballard's really looking to get at when he's talking about the characters dreaming and the strange dreams?
Well, they say they're going back to their sort of early evolutionary.
Yeah. But it's not evolution, it's devolution. It's a return back to the primitive stage of fear, fight, reaction, elements from that sort of basis. So how does that connect, as I said, in this initial thing, and why did I actually decide to give you the opportunity of an and-or, and how can I actually develop these two things if we're looking at the sort of two things in operation? Well, let's sort of take a slight diversion to some of the key things that we've come across here. Yeah. Well, that would wake you up. Whoa. We're in a couple of years, about 3 or 4 years after Drowning World hit the bookshelves. Frank Herbert's Dune is very much an epic novel, the beginning of a saga, if you like, but set on an alternate planetary history in the far-flung future. We heard the introduction, was read by Virginia Madsen, portraying the Princess Irulan in this particular aspect. But it's also being written at a time when, as far as ecology is concerned, people are being to be just a little bit conscious of the environment. This whole notion of eco-criticism comes into place. That's the dedication that Herbert put in the first edition of Dune. And I think it makes it quite clear from his perspective, unlike the slightly more ambivalent Ballard tendency, whereas really dedication as such, it sort of works through there, that Herbert is very clearly looking at the whole notion of ecology as a viable, worthwhile science. That, in essence, is the science of science fiction. That really is at the heart of both The Drowned World and Dune in terms of this ecological element. Unlike RUR, and unlike The Time Machine, it's not so much the technology that's actually being analysed and looked at and explored, it's how do we relate to that whole process. It's how do we relate to water. Now, you've got, in many ways, the perfect binary opposition initially between the drowned world, where there's water, water everywhere, and not a drop to drink, as the Ancient Mariner would say, and Dune, where it is a desert planet, until, of course, the very end, spoiler, in which case it becomes re-fertilised, revitalised through the religious actions and the messiah actions of the Kwisatz Haderach, also known as Paul Atreides. And the question that I've put several times over the years, actually, because I started giving a paper focused primarily on Dune back at the University of Luton back in 1998, so back in the 20th century. But it's still relevant today in terms of, does Dune actually function as just a straight ecological narrative, which says this is the kind of thing that can happen if you overexploit the oil in the Middle East and you create problems with the environment and so on, or you over-rely on technology or machines? Or is it also the ultimate religious fear? You know, we looked at the first slide in terms of In Search of St. Anthony and the heavenly St. Anthony and his lines from that. At some deep-seated level, we are arguably all as human beings asking the same fundamental questions. Who created us? Why are we here? And at various levels, that Psi philosophy element is being asked by Frank Herbert, and it's also being asked by Ballard in terms of The Drowned World. To the initial reader, again, you might come away thinking, well, does anybody really catch your imagination in terms of worthwhile characters? I mean, Herbert tends to write more in the broader strokes of events, and again talks about the whole notion, as one of his characters, planetologist of Arrakis, actually says, that ultimately it's all about balance. It's all about reaching that critical point. Again, no major surprise to that. You've also got this manifest in Malthus, who suggested that if you're in a world in which the population is increasing geometrically, otherwise going 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, whereas food production is increasing only arithmetically, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, it doesn't really take a great deal of time before the number of people on the planet will far outstrip the means that exists to feed them. Again, that question that's put there, it's interesting in terms of the quote that Herbert puts together to his character. The human question is not how many can possibly survive within the system, but what kind of existence is possible for those who do survive. Let's go back to The Drowned World. Consider the existence that they're both in. Consider the existence of The Drowned World. Hands up, if you've read The Drowned World, if you really said, yes, if only the Braven could rise 6 feet tomorrow, that's exactly where I want to be. I want to be completely submerged. Go for it. So that whole notion of the gymnosperms and the ancient, all the things that are sort of coming through, doesn't really appeal somehow.
I'm on the water to rise 6 feet, the Braven isn't the one I choose.
Really?
No, it's happened before. Filthy.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah, a few years ago, very nearly, you know, we were literally on standby, because if it had gone up a couple more inches, the sort of the ground floor would have actually, you know, basically been completely flooded on the whole basis, and lots of other sort of areas. So Rupert Hilliard, actually, I mean, I'm sure he's shared tales of he's living in kind of the flood capital of York, and it's happened a few times from that sort of point of view. So, you know, clearly we're existing in terms of areas where, you know, we're aware of this, but the thing with the drowned world is it's not just happened, it's there, it's going to stay there. There's no indication that it's going to actually go away. These are consistent changes. But then, you know, we tend to think of things being permanent. Is that also another illusion when it comes to time? That illusion of permanency. That it doesn't matter whether it's 1,000 years, 10,000 years, 100,000 years. Actually, it's all part of that shifting and narrative and structure and so on. One of the things which Dune also attempted to do was to connect both the theological paradigms of a dominant religious body, which in the case of Dune, if you get around to reading it, is very much modelled on the medieval Borgias and the notion of the Bene Gesserit sisterhood, who would effectively look to control the universe. And it's interesting that Herbert very much, as the name would suggest, focuses the Bene Gesserit sisterhood on the controlling, manipulative, as he sees it, female of the species being much more deadlier than the male as well. It also ties in very much with a spiritual awareness of the cosmos. We heard in that opening sequence there about the spice melange. Herbert in Dune doesn't talk about huge planetary rocket ships. He does talk about huge planetary transporters that effectively are shifted from one planet to the other via the folding of space, via the guild navigators who effectively are sourced by the spice melange. It's like a massive hedge trip in terms of how you're actually moving from one particular planet to another. It might be worthwhile just to actually put some flesh on those bones to give you an indication from Dune and its Amazon Prime location about what I'm actually referring to in that. Let me just pull up the wee bit now.
Here we are now, captain, and 19 light years beyond any lilacs.
The trained pilot of the Mentats, the human computers, Noah Mentat by his red stained lips.
There, Arrakis.
Spice of mine. Carry all, lower the harvester to the sand, and lift it off to safety when a worm attacks. Worms attack all rhythmic vibrations. Weather. Sea storms. No precipitation.
One drop of rain on Arrakis. And our Conans are near. There. Gigi Prime and the Baron Harkonnen. The enemy.
Baron Harkonnen has sworn to destroy House Atreides and steal the Ducal Signet Ring for himself.
Pop quiz question. Oh, you can actually see the answers there, never mind. Anyways, you can see pretty much David Lynch. Almost royalty there, Patrick Stewart before he became John Luke Picard, Kyle MacLachlan before he became Agent Dale Cooper, Dean Stockwell before he actually took on board the role of Al, the friendly hologram for Sam in Quantum Leap, and Freddie Francis, of course, emerges in a whole range of other elements within that. Anybody ever seen the David Lynch Dune movie? It's a treat that you can look forward to. It's actually not quite as... some critics sort of said it didn't quite capture the spirit of the novel. I would disagree. I think it does for the first half at least, and then possibly loses ground a little bit towards the end. But nevertheless, as we saw there, one of the key things that the character of Kyle MacLachlan, who's playing Paul Muad'Dib, Paul Atreides in this instance, son of the Duke Leto Atreides in House Caladan, is the notion of how important water is as a life force, the giver of life, the bringer of life, and so on. And Ballard kind of does the same thing with respect to the drowned world. You know, baptismal waters, the sense of rebirth, the sense of re-emergence, sense of passage, sense of shifting from one dimension to the other. Dare I say it, currently, given its Oscar nomination, Shape of Water, and the sort of notion of a mermaid, a mer creature, and connecting within that. There's something deep in our psyche that connects us with water, not least of which is the fact that we are made up of 90% water. Take out the water, you've basically got a few pounds of chemicals and salts and various other bits and pieces together. And that's what makes us up. We are, quote, many science fiction writers, mostly bags of water that happen to be animated with some kind of spirit that keeps us going. That's a thought to guide us through the next few days and few hours. Is there anything else, though, in terms of the characters that we see, in terms of the drowned world, that maybe actually, there we are, in terms of thinking of an essay to do, is there any relation between the drowned world and the time machine? Is there? Or could we have actually quite easily started off this whole sequence with the drowned world, or indeed not even bother with the drowned world at all and actually focus on something completely different? Why, in terms of that whole connection of the drowned world and the time machine, is there a connection?
With the time machine, time traveller goes to a world where humanity has sort of devolved, so I guess sort of same thing happens in the drowned world, but we're already there.
That's certainly one. Another one? Deals with the Earth over a period of time. It deals with the breakdown in society. Deals with the sort of notions of how there are still attempts to keep society together after a fashion. Again, you conceivably have a main male lead character who is an explorer. The difference being, of course, in the drowned world, he's actually named.
Could you just argue that those are just common tropes of the literature that we're looking at, though?
Yeah.
Instead of saying other texts related in any way, but they are through the common tropes that make up this type.
I would, but I think when we come back after Reading Week and we look at 2001: A Space Odyssey, you're seeing a whole new genre. You're seeing space opera, and although you do see areas connected with the journey there, I think what Ballard's actually looking to do here is, as I've mentioned, this notion of the inner journey, the notion of actually travelling within. To find out how that, in other words, internalizing the external, or conceivably externalizing the internal in terms of that. Did anybody actually get the sense that Ballard was preaching? Or sort of, yes.
I don't think directly in the sense like the narrative is, but I still wonder more like when reading and I thought, wow, it was good. Potentially with how the environment is now, it could potentially happen. So I don't think narrative-wise, he did. It didn't work straightforward. But I think when reading it overall, I'm trying to think of what's happening in the moment, it is potential.
I would agree. I mean, I think what you get is almost, dare I say, a kind of British approach to science fiction, where it's very descriptive. It's not really analytical. It's not really unpicking why these things have happened. We're kind of expected to sort of see that they have happened and so be it. Whereas if I return back to the notion of this one, yes, there's my old favourite, which I keep coming back to. Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. But also, you see that what Herbert also looks to put together is this notion of why are there no computers as such or super sophisticated machines on Dune? Now Ballard would probably just describe it, machines are gone, there was no power, and so on. Herbert, on the other hand, specifically references the whole notion of future history by that particular statement. In other words, a new particular religious force, the Orange Catholic Bible, as opposed to the before Guild Navigators. And again, a really interesting line that he actually talks about, which is why we see in Dune a whole whole race of mentats, or living computer machine-based hybrids. Not cyborgs, but calculating humans who actually calculate their particular aspect, because
The line was, actually, you shall not make a machine in the likeness of a human mind. So I think we can pretty much see exactly where, if you're looking for the authorial intent, that actually comes from, and so on. And Herbert also starts referencing the notion of the internal. That's a particular mantra that's very much focused in the challenge that Paul Atreides, here, actually sort of starts talking about when he's given his first test by one of the Reverend Mothers in terms of pain by nerve induction. And again, I'll be able to hopefully sort of give you a little shortcut of this in terms of what he's actually going through within that. But you don't have to be, you know, a huge believer in the Buddhist Nam-myoho-renge-kyo or any particular chance to actually sort of focus on how do you actually calm, how do you visualise your sort of sequence, to actually get too far beyond this whole notion of understanding. Now, in Drowned World, there isn't really that particular element of understanding and coming to grips with life, unless it's seen on the kind of geophysical sense. Let's see if I can actually just find this piece from June, which I think comes up around about 18. Oops. No.
Thank you.
Mother Gaia's Helen Maria. She's going to observe you. Please, Jessica. You know it must be done.
Eurylance.
What does she fear?
What about my father?
People react in this time where clearly an ecological catastrophe has actually occurred, and unlike Dune and so on, it's how we actually develop and work through that that kind of makes the whole narrative develop. We've talked about the planetarium. What about the City of London? Because obviously there is a period in the text where we feel as though actually there might be a way in which somehow we can drive the waters back. We can actually go and see London as it was. All right, it's stinking and it's full of all kinds of detritus that have been left behind where the dam has been put together. But then that's pretty much seen as a futile gesture. Now, do you think that's part of the notion that Ballard is suggesting that ultimately life is futile? That actually the sense of, oh, total apathy, and even when Kearns leaves in the end, he's sort of heading south. He's not going north, he's heading south to probably sort of complete the whole journey. Is that optimistic? Is it positive? Does it say anything to us on some deep-rooted level? Or would you prefer the notion that there's a meta-narrative at work here in terms of it's more than just a metaphor that's here or an allegory? It's actually using something to describe the existential nature of the human condition.
Let it go
complex. Mm, absolutely. CBA, can't be asked.
It makes sense to go, when he decides to go south, it makes sense because it's drier. It's going to be drier. Well, certainly, it goes to Scotland, it rains in London, it's going to be fine. You go down to Cornwall, you get very little rain.
Although I think, in this particular instance, it would suggest that actually it was drier in the north, apparently, as opposed to the south, so the line that seems to be through from that. What about this line here, that something that Ballard himself has written when he was alive? Symbols used by a writer take their impetus from the most formative and confused period of our lives, which are often time sculptures of terrifying ambiguity. A bit like having all lectures in the science fiction module in English in your third year taking place all at the same time, simultaneously with a dissertation as well. Is that something which is an accurate representation of the psyche? Because this is, I think, far more than what we actually have looked at previously. This is really an exploration of the inner psyche. We keep coming back to that in terms of how the characters are actually portrayed, how we kind of get a sense of what is madness, what is that sort of sense that sort of drives the folk over the top. And there are various folk who effectively commit suicide in terms of the way that things work. Is it a case of he's looking at them in terms of those time sculptures? Let's go back to that image I actually sort of looked at beforehand, sorry, image that's just down here. And obviously, Dali's also known for his signs of clocks kind of curving in on themselves. Or is that just a case of, well, he's an artist, obviously he's surreal, he's writing about the real itself. Well, does anybody actually know what the surrealists' objectives were? What were they trying to do? You know, this movement of Dadaists, wanted to kind of get rid of all the structures on Chien Andalus and Bunuel's 22-minute movie, which... Has anybody ever seen on Chien Andalou? Yeah, yes. So the eye being slit open, the eyeballs being slit open. So what's it all about?
The film?
Yeah. Oh, well, surrealism.
The Western first year of film studies, it's like... a juxtaposition of images that don't really sequence in.
In other words, the avowed aim, the stated aim, was to destroy narrative, destroy any linearity, any sense of linearity. So all things are truly occurring simultaneously. That life is flux, that effectively it's a whole series of different images all coalescing together. I mean, it's interesting that cosmologists now are kind of coming around to the notion that maybe all realities exist simultaneously. And we have bubble universes, that things sort of occur in different areas, etc. Does that relate to the whole notion of ambiguity and the notion of did you say who has actually finished The Drowning World? Yeah, okay. So were you satisfied with the finish? Do you, that sort of closing sort of area where he goes off, and you know, we're sort of left wondering. We're not left wondering what exactly he does. What did you make of it?
It's kind of the same as the ending of All Your All, really, wasn't it? Ambiguous and
I mean, there are folk who would say that's one of the real irritations of certain brands of science fiction. And that's why I want you to just spend a couple of seconds looking at these two quotes here. I mentioned, obviously, the New Worlds area. New Worlds was actually a British science fiction magazine that was set up by Michael Moorcock, Brian Aldiss, and J.G. Ballard, specifically to look to that whole side of things. And you can see, in terms of his descriptors there, that, you know, Ballard is much more interested in terms of the psychological aspects of science fiction rather than those external ones. In fact, he's explicitly critical of the space race. So one of the cultural things which was really at the heart of a massive influx, a massive surge in popularity, not only in attempted predictive science fiction, but also in terms of space opera, Star Trek, adaptations thereof, and so on and so forth, Star Wars. Interesting, again, you can also see the connection between the force in Star Wars and the control of the voice, in this particular case, control of males by the voice. It was first introduced by Frank Herbert in terms of a technique called the voice to actually manipulate and influence and guide people to do what you wanted them to do as well. Yeah, it's an interesting line for it, but that's another thing, and we're not comparing Star Wars and Dune because that's a whole other session and seminar. But in terms of the two things that he's looking for there, and also the second chunk quote that comes through there, wanting to see science fiction SF becoming a system which invents fresh situations and contexts that illustrate its theme obliquely. Is that ultimately say, yeah, I'd like to spend the entire 11 weeks focusing on that rather than sort of opening up various other areas? Because it can be quite challenging in terms of what Ballard's saying and what arguably is a form of science fiction writing and beliefs. Any comments? What do you think? Oh, no, be lost. In fact, or celebrate your lostness, because in being lost, it's a sort of a first steps towards wisdom. So that's good. It's good that you're lost from that point of view. Do you prefer science fiction more philosophical? Or do you, in other words, people saying more than just what would happen if? Questioning everything from the very perception filters that we use to get through the world. Or do you prefer something that's quite clearly outlined? What's happening, who the good guys are, who the bad guys are, that's the narrative, fulfills the first function, that's good SF.
I prefer the latter, but, you know, not. I don't always like it when you instinctively know who's good and who's evil. I quite like it if there's a nice twist where you think the bad person was actually all right, or the good person was, you know. But when it gets really philosophical, I just sit there and I think, it's got so convoluted in my head, like with Jude, it got so convoluted, I didn't know what was happening. Who was who? I was like, I don't
want to
know anymore. I just
want to
walk away and never look back.
That's what happened with me. Yeah. Dune isn't that complicated a novel. It looks big. It looks complicated.
I'm just an idiot.
No. I don't know. I think that's equally as wrong. Because you mean, but I think you probably need to have you. You didn't see the TV series either, because also no. I mean, The Handle is primarily on Herbert writing this ecological parable, and you have the battle for control. And if you can kind of use the metaphor that what you've got with the Chome houses of Dune, of House Atreides, House Harkonnen, the Emperor's house, etc., and the Fremen of Dune is a manifestation for the Soviet Union, the United States, and the Arab states in the 1960s. Use that as a paradigm, as an analogy, you'll find it slots into place a lot easier.
I will try again.
It's okay. It's fine. What about yourself?
Again, very similar. Like, I do enjoy it when it is clean cut, but then again, I do like nice philosophical, where you don't know who's who, but more clearly presented in a way. Because like, I got lost in, like you say, houses and characters and who's who, and why are these people magic, and why are these people being controlled, where the sandworms coming from, all that stuff. But if I had a handle on it and knew where everybody's sat into place, I'm sure I'd enjoy it a lot more. Mm. But it was very intimidating on the first read, and I kind of deferred to other modules for reading for this week.
I would probably suggest that actually there's nothing in Dune that is more complicated than what Tolkien does in Lord of the Rings.
True, but I grew up with Tolkien.
Ah, yes, you see, this is it. Blame on the parents.
Try again.
You
try to take Tolkien
away from
me
all day.
I'll give you two
timelines
when you're done,
but you are looking remarkably well for somebody who grew up with Tolkien, so that's very good. Anyway, yes.
I haven't read Dune, I've got halfway through. travel over.
As it was just a stage of thinking, that's it, I can't be going
in. I could try and sit down and read it, but it's quite scientific, which is quite like off putting for me. Like, I don't think there's that much that actually happened from what I got up to. I got to the bit where he was under water and all that, just after that bit. And I don't think before that point nothing really happened. Describing the surroundings.
Well, that's part of the frustration, of course, because what I found particularly irritating was the notion that you're still suggesting that there's a place for privateers and pirates and folk to actually sell their goods, etc. And obviously you're still seeing the worst aspects of men as opposed to working together on that sort of basis. Thoughts?
How did you do, and how did they drown Rover? From the question about if you liked everything to be questioned or to be straightforward. I like question everything. I like to love the possible dollar possible of question everything. I don't have to need some kind of I just need some kind of structure there. I think I need some guidelines to be like, okay, some context of this is how we've got to here, and then I don't mind if you question everything after that. I just need some kind of...
So you would like Ballard to effectively have outlined more than just accept the world, this is what it is. Okay. Once you've read both, has it just blown your head completely and you just sort of like, I can't cope anymore?
Yeah, I guess I don't really prefer it either, but I like a bit of philosophical narrative. I don't like black and white characters, like good and bad, because I prefer sort of grey characters. It's more interesting, so...
Certainly morally ambiguous characters, and morally ambiguous characterisations. So, I mean, if I just look back to... Let's see, back to this one again. Actually, the only time you probably don't have any morally ambiguous characters would probably be Ursula K. Le Guin's Get. Well, actually, even Get is really the character of Case in Neuromancer, Washman, Embassy Town. So again, we've got a lot of ambiguity here, but I think in terms of Chiding Angel's Embassy Town, that plays around a great deal with the whole notion of not only language, but also sort of characterizations and lines with respect to that whole system. Where are we? Yes. Thoughts?
I think I prefer... I mean, I like texts that do sort of engage with philosophical questions, but I do prefer ones that have a structured story and a narrative.
Well, Dune certainly has that. It's a very long narrative. And it goes, I mean, initially after, because of the success of the first book, Dune, you've got subsequent Frank Herbert offerings, Dune Messiah, Children of Dune, God Emperor of Dune, several other sequels as well that have been written. There's a whole series of computer games that have been based on the Dune package. I mean, it's very much a world creation element that works through that. Drowned World has kind of just sat there as, yes, that's very worthy, yes, that's opened up sort of some examples. Maybe it'll be picked up again in years to come. Who knows? As I say, it took 100 years before a sequel to... Actually, it wasn't quite 100 years, but I mean, the main sequel to The Time Machine was actually written, so...
I liked the philosophical conclusions of the Tremulous that lots of the theory was talking about, where he kind of... He's going off to be the next Adam in fucking New Kingdom. I thought it wasn't really explored in the novel, but, that's an interesting idea. But he's going to die anyway because he's shot in the leg, so...
My thoughts behind that is it also implies, rather than making explicit, it implies a connection between religion and science at one level. That ultimately when science fails, the suggestion is we turn to religion or we turn to beliefs, which may be based in superstition, they may be based in experience for whatever reason, but there is that sense of the unknown, the supernatural. And ultimately that is another element which comes across in both Dune and the Drowned World, which is the awesome power of nature. That in comparison to the worlds and the apparently simple climates of dry desert, wet, drowned worlds and so on, humanity is actually not powerless, but a lot weaker than we might sort of think we would like to be. I mean, if we go back to the first clip I showed from the trailer for the day the Earth caught fire, there is that sort of sense that you're left waiting, and the kind of the narrative develops is this whole sense that, you know, we're waiting for the end of the world, and there's that sense of the apocalypse coming through. Can we remind you who did the After the End module here? So, yeah, I'm not speaking, you know, I'm just going to, okay. But your own.
I often discuss the texts and the films Jeffrey I have to watch with my friends, and he says that I'm very lazy because I like things spoon-fed to me. But I'm just, if it's too complex, I get lost. So, but I love Game of Thrones. So I don't really understand the
Thrones. That's very peculiar then.
But I never read Tolkien when I was growing up because when she said there was too much, this is this, and this is why this is, and this is what they're like. And I don't like that. I like to just go straight into the content of the novel. But then when we were doing it After the End, I loved when we were like studying The Walking Dead and stuff like that, examining the philosophical, you've got good guys and bad guys, but the good guys are doing exactly the same as the bad guys, but you side with them. So I like that sort of philosophical approach to it. But when you're looking at references to biblical texts and stuff like that, I don't buy into that.